Bippity bitty bitty bitty.
Check. Check. Level check. Great. Hi, Julian. Welcome.
Hello.
Welcome to Wombat Radio. Everybody else who's listening. So we can also just cut out anything you
want to
cut out.
Yeah. Cool. Like swearing.
And we'll just do a clap and then look back through the file. I know. Oh, there's a bit where Julian swore at me and threw some shit.
Yeah.
What do you think is a way, like, if there was one word that everybody who knew you would agree on that describes you?
God.
Do you have any idea what that word might be?
Calm.
Yeah. How does that happen?
How does calm happen?
I know it's a big question.
Calm happens for me, I guess, because I listen. And I like listening, and it takes me a while to make noise, so I end up listening a lot more, if that makes sense.
I think it makes sense. And do you mean when it comes to discussion, or also when it comes to music, or when it comes to being in the world, or...?
I was referring to discussion, but I sort of tend to slide into things.
Uh-huh. That's what my sister accuses me of when I sing. I always slide onto the note, which is, yeah, exactly. Which is maybe endearing, but not... not something people would pay to see.
Depends on the style.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And what are you busy with? And it could be just what you're thinking about as well. It doesn't mean what you're...
Yeah, true. Well, I'm traveling a lot. A lot. I'm usually not in a place more than a couple of weeks, and sort of spread all over the world these last couple of years, both for my own projects or working for other people, but also for study. I'm studying Feldenkrais and other things. And I sort of just follow where the learning is. If that makes sense. So this morning I was trying to learn more about these ideas of robotics, and not that I know anything about robotics. I just mean in terms of, you know, this the idea of the end of work or the automization. Mm. Is that a word?
Yes.
The ideas surrounding, you know, how society needs to shift to allow that to happen, or in response to, and also, you know, taking into account how, you know, yesterday you were talking about this idea of pacing and humanity going too fast or something, and then at the other side then needs to be this sort of collapse or something, or slowing down, forced slowing down to, like, take in the environment, to take in
the
what's
only
actually
response
happening.
To a broken system is for it to break. In the end, if you just keep turning it up and up and up, a system that has a fault will eventually show that fault. Yeah.
Whether it needs to break first is the question.
Yeah, hopefully not. Because I feel like a lot of the things that people consider when it comes to the roboticization of what were employment opportunities, or the automation of what were employment opportunities, I think that it's easy to think that that is something that's in the future, but I think that it's something that's already here. And the way that we've responded so far is that we've tried to keep the old system a little bit and not change the way that the economy is designed. So the economy is designed thinking that each person has to work so that they can contribute, and they need to work in something that somebody is willing to pay them money for.
Hmm. And they need the money so that they can buy the things that they're making.
Yeah. But hopefully if the... I mean, I can only refer to say that there used to be so many jobs with people doing very dangerous work mining underground, and then over time that has become more mechanized operation, and we've lost a lot of jobs. And I would argue from a place of privilege that it's good that we don't have people in those environments anymore.
Hmm.
And it's a sign of progress that there are not people doing those jobs, that there are machines doing those jobs. And I think that hopefully we'll get there where it comes to paperwork and bureaucracy, that that's just an algorithm that can file itself and sort itself. But then a little bit of the anarchist in me hopes that that doesn't follow to its logical conclusion of becoming a cashless society, because I like the idea that the people can operate without being tracked at all angles. That somehow there's a level of... There's a tension between complete transparency, especially to authority organizations, and then the other tension, which is... maybe my business is just my business when it comes to cash. And so I don't know. That was a really quick tangent. But if we go back to what you were talking about Feldenkrais, you reminded me when you say study and then you say a movement practice, I know that that means that you will be thinking and reading and writing and moving as a practice of study. But I imagine a lot of other things, to study something means just to read it or to talk about it. Right. And I wonder, I'm interested in what your experience has been from studying music to studying body practices to studying dance. And if you're always going where the learning is and how the learning, the way that you are asked to learn. I'm interested in all the different ways that you've been asked to learn by the people who are the holders of that knowledge.
I mean, there's a lot in there. I've learned lots of different things. You know, there's the various instruments, you know, all the things, of course, in school and sports and martial arts and then all the other artistic stuff. And I always felt that I was, you know, pretty good at finding the links between things. And not good at other things. Other aspects of learning. Especially to do with sort of consistency or following things through to the end. You know, which for me never had a very strong pull.
No. But I would propose that the end is often very arbitrarily set.
Yeah, sure. But it's a useful goal. You know, it can be
to set you on your path.
Yeah,
it's definitely a useful goal. But there's also the idea that you can get to 80 or 90% proficiency with 20% of the effort. And then if you want the last 10 or 15% of proficiency that takes you into being incredible or excellent or whatever, it takes the rest of your effort, like the next 90% of your ability to apply yourself. I know my percentages are all out of whack.
I don't know, but I'm also interested in this idea of effort. You know, that's a very big idea in Feldenkrais. And I guess what drew me to that practice and what continues to be, you know, infinitely generative is that it's helped me to unfurl or unpack or peel back the layers of learning or peel back the layers of reality and to see and move in between these layers. so that, for instance, it becomes obvious that everything is the same in many ways. You know, you are learning dancing by learning to play an instrument. You know, the fundamental things are all the same. You know, all this business of moving attention, of spreading attention, of awareness and what that means, all these how you perceive and how you interpret what you're perceiving and how you, you know, monitor yourself and self-organize in relationship to yourself, to your environment, to other people. These fundamental things that exist within all different practices.
The thing that I enjoy the most about learning something that you have to practice to learn it is that it's almost a zoom in, that you're zooming into the articulation or the embodiment or conquering the fear that would stop you from executing that pathway. And it's a different way to inhabit than the zoom out that we often exist in of logistic organization or of community interaction or something. Like, it's nice to go from an individual attempting something and then zoom out a bit to the systems that are interrelating within your body to attempt that thing, and then zoom out further to the other bodies that you are interrelating with, to zoom out further to the other non-human consciousnesses and energies. And there's some kind of reminder of humanity or empathy with the zooming. It's like somehow learning it is a good exercise in knowing that what you're doing is very important, but it's probably not very significant.
Yeah. That's a tough one. I mean just to keep in the mix, you know, it's very easy to let that one drift away and then get lost. And then it comes hurtling back and you get punched in the face and then...
And how would you describe that hurtling back when it's coming at you?
It depends. Sometimes it's a very pleasant feeling and sometimes it's not. Yeah. Sometimes you're in a spiral and then the belly just drops out and you fall into a deeper lostness and which you have to go either through. Yeah, you have to go through to come back out.
Yeah.
It's like sometimes,
epiphany and surprise and shock are all the same thing.
Yeah. But also sometimes you just have an experience and you I guess there are things that people describe as transcendence or feeling of oneness or also which is kind of this same thing.
I would say in talking about it, it's the same thing. And I'm interested when you've experienced that transcendence or oneness. Is it when you're doing or when you're viewing or when you're listening or when you're...
Thinking about the question, it's very clear to me that I have felt these things and in many different contexts but... It's one of those things that is also really elusive.
Yeah.
And in the same practice or in the same, you know, you might be looking at a mountain or standing on a mountain, or you might be in the midst of a beautiful dance or something, and in that one moment you have it. And then it's gone on either sides of that moment, and you know that it happened, but the when and the where, and they sort of also disappear sometimes.
Which is maybe poetic, that in that moment usually you disappear. And so as soon as you get yourself back from the transcendence or the oneness or whatever, then you leave behind knowing when it was and what it was and how it was.
Yeah, because the sense of self sort of dissolves.
Yeah. But I sometimes get that. Well, I guess it's why I chase immersion.
Immersion.
Being immersed in my project or something. And I see it across all fields of people who really get into their work, actually.
Mm.
I've seen it happen even with crane drivers, operators on work sites or on trucks or whatever, that they are so in their work that they've become more than themselves. And there's something, there's like a new window into viewing that. But it's also sometimes happens with games. I want to ask you about playing an instrument versus playing a game.
I would love if people set me musical games more. I have an abundance of attention for games. Mm-hmm. and I guess, you know, that's their lure, because if they're well constructed, they draw you in and they provide just the right amount of challenge or reward or whatever it is, or fear.
What style of game do you feel like works best for you?
I really like role-playing games.
Okay.
I kind of like strategy. I like the idea of strategy games.
Like tower defense games, or more like bigger, larger, like city building and things like that.
I like the idea of those, like Civilization, or but I think I'm better at something on the time scale of like Settlers of Catan, like an hour long, which while I'm sure people can get really good at, it's not to the same level of. Oh, maybe I don't know. As something, I don't know. There's something. Well, I'm also not very competitive.
Okay, yeah. And there's something about playing a game that you're just trying to exist within the game and work it out and have the joy of continuing. It's not about beating somebody or beating yourself. Which I imagine is often the same when you're playing an instrument, that you play it to play it, not to win.
Although, you know, growing up, that was also, you know, when you had exams. You know, there's... I have, you know, a major... I understand that it can be useful, these sorts of goals. But, you know, I think too often they're made important and significant.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious if you you play games and you play music, and I wonder if you play Feldenkrais.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a lot of fun in Feldenkrais.
So tell me what happens? How you inhabit that?
It depends what kind of detail we're looking at. Feldenkrais, it uses movement.
Yeah.
So people describe it as a movement practice, and I guess it is, I guess. But but it doesn't really mean anything. Everything is a movement practice. You have to, you know, it requires some movement of something, of attention, of something through time. But we're sort of, I won't speak in we. I'll just
subjective.
Me. Yeah. My practice. It's sort of, like I was saying before about the layers. So going into myself and just really gently asking, you know, what is it and who is it that I am right now? And again, who is it and what is it that I am right now and right now? And in doing it in different ways, and you can gather tools to do it in different ways, like different imaginative tools to go, how can I know that my limbs are here? How can I know that I'm in relation to something? The most basic and fundamental is, and the most one of the most generative is always the relationship with the floor and with gravity. But also with the breath, you know, breathing in the air that everyone else has breathed and everything else is breathing. And this constant movement of, you know, within you. So there are different tools, different ideas of zooming in and zooming out, foreground and background, of
self and beyond self.
Attention. So what are you paying attention to? You know, this time and this time and this time and this time. And every time you have a realization, the next realization has to be different. It cannot be the same.
Because you've shifted.
Yeah. You've gone somewhere by that realization. So it's important. You know, like, this is me. But to then just let it go and let it drift by and allow room for the next realization.
That can be quite scary.
Yeah. Some realizations are more tricky than others.
Mm.
You know, there's more of a build up, there's more of a release. There's sometimes you find more of yourself or what you perceive to be yourself and a sense of homeness, and sometimes you lose more of that sense of homeness, at least temporarily, until you recalibrate and include this new aspect into yourself. And sometimes the lessons are gentle and funny and pleasurable, and sometimes, yeah,
they're a smack in the face.
Yeah. Or they're touching and sad, and you know, especially when old memories come up, or you know, these sorts of things, or realizations of the pathway that you've been walking that you've been trying not to walk, but you're still going there, and that's okay.
What are your thoughts or experiences about the answers or the knowledge that the body has that the mind can't access, or that the thinking in words are not going to get us to? I'm just curious about the intelligence of the body and integrating that in a society that's structured so literally.
Since we're using words, one of my teachers, Julie Peck, is really strong about the idea that maybe you don't need to use the words the body. And that you can just talk about myself, you know, or yourself. This is my back part of me. This is my foot part of me. And of course, people have, you know, varying degrees of selfness related to various parts of themselves. You know, a singer has more connection to their mouth and their throat and their lungs than people who are not singers. Or many people do not have a very strong connection to their toes or to their feet, especially if they wear shoes all the time, or, you know, these sort of things. Or the back is often lost.
The back is often lost.
The pelvis. Wait, can you bring me back to the question?
The question
intelligence
is about
of the body, right?
And the answers that the body might have for us.
I was reading this mind-blowing book called The Potent Self by Moshe Feldenkrais recently that took me a long time to read because it just takes me a long time to read, and I get a couple of paragraphs or I get a couple of pages and then that's enough for the next couple of weeks, you know. There's so much to ponder. Oh my God, just got lost again. Say it again.
The things that the body might have for ourselves, that
the things
if we are just thinking about ourselves as our thoughts or as our head and hands.
Oh. So one, you know, I don't understand most of that book.
Yes.
Right? But he was talking about how thought and thought can only sort of, I don't really have the right words, but sort of exist in reality or have any sort of meaning in relation to bodily experience.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. There's a similar idea, you know, for language that you experience something and then you attach a word to it.
Yeah.
And if you have no experience, you can't form language.
Yeah. If you don't have a body, there is no such thing as right or left. You cannot have that experience, or you cannot have that concept with any sort of reality. But once, you know, once you have the experience, then you can. Yeah. You can separate it more.
And there's some experiences that we have grown beyond in terms of our understanding, but we're still holding on to our own old relationship to it.
Yeah.
Like there's a book by Buckminster Fuller, and he wrote a few, so I'm not sure which one it is, but he was talking about that as soon as we all agreed that the earth was not flat anymore, then we are now beyond talking about up or down. We have to now talk about in or out from our center point of gravity. And I think about this only in relation to when I'm teaching a contemporary technique class and I'm talking about floor work, we're always going into or out of the floor.
Yeah.
But if I was helping someone lift something into their ute, I would be lifting it up for them, or I'd be lifting it down. I would not be lifting it out of, away from the earth or into the center of our shared gravity. I mean, that's not how I think about it.
Yeah.
In the way that our society talks about these things. And somehow there's always a lag between the language that we use and the new discoveries that we make.
Yeah. But like everything, I think it's a, if we understand it as a tool, I mean, and that's really tricky because it's very, like, it's much easier to see other people than it is to see yourself. because language is you know, our way of expressing, our way of communicating, our way of thinking in many ways, our way of ordering the world, it's more difficult to step outside of it, to look back in at the way you use your words or what of words are available to you.
My greatest hope for creating an experience that somebody will come and see, whether that's in music or dance or any other medium, is that I will make something that will give them a moment of not having any words to say in response to it, which is just the expression of taking someone's breath away. And it's, I guess it's a romantic idea of what a performance or what an artwork can do. But the ability to make something that could give somebody a moment of experience beyond comment or critique or relationship to it from their word-based self or something is really what I'm trying to. And I, you know, I guess that's also summed up in the phrase of gobsmacked or blown away or something like that.
But it's also, I was just thinking, like, to stay in that place, to have it ride more than a moment, people have to have a palette of
other medium to think in,
yeah, or
exist in.
To be able to make distinctions between different sensory experiences which are unwordable.
So that they can live
there.
Yes.
Otherwise, then it's just a mush, an unrecognizable difference from their ordinary being, and they will go away from it straight away.
It's only defined as other.
Yeah.
Rather than being defined as and by itself.
Yeah. So then, yeah, how you make that?
Do you experience this when you're performing? Do you experience a knowing of things beyond? Well, I guess there's an internal dialogue of what needs to happen. And for a while that is conscious and it's in words because you're trying to remember the structure. And then you get to a certain point where the internal dialogue is still there, but the dialogue is no longer word-based somehow.
Well, I guess it depends on what process you use to come by the dance. So with Rhiannon Newton, I mean, she uses words to evoke particular things or invoke particular... evoke, I think. but it's very... But she also uses a lot of sensory experience, like a lot of touch work, to build up what that word could mean. And each time we come back to the trigger, she tries to provide a different experience of what that could mean. And then allows them all to exist, even while having a vague goal of aesthetically maybe what she might be looking for. And of those experiences are deeply personal, and that personal relationship is very important, I think, in that process. And their histories, or the people's histories. So yeah, that it's different than working with someone who tells you what to do, for instance, and has a this is a kind of step, and this is how it should be done. Especially if it has names like in ballet, for instance. Well, I mean,
But also, martial arts, they have names for their steps. Yes,
exactly. And that can be very useful or it can be not. It depends on your palate. And your ability to make sense of the palate.
How do you make sense of all the things that you do?
By dropping their significance is a big one. And allowing bringing more of myself into each one, if that makes sense. Because the more that, for instance, my playing of the cello is less my playing of the cello, but just me and the cello and us together and from my toes to my hair, then the easier it is for that, everything that is that experience, or those many collections of experiences, to generalize, to be available when I'm doing the dishes, when I sing, because the parts overlap. The relationships come together.
How did that start?
I mean, I think I've been playing with it since I was very young. Like, parts of the ideas, you know, parts of the drawing these spider webs of connection. You know, like, if I can do a wave with my fingers and follow the flow of water in a pool, of course I can do a wave when I'm playing a piano.
Of course.
Yeah. Or, you know, why? Of course. but, you know, for a long time, those little ideas and those little links were sort of separate from each other. And now more and more and more and faster and faster and faster, they're not separate from each other. So I don't know if I can pinpoint a time or an experience.
Sometimes I just wonder about how it began, because I just imagine that so many of us become who we become because of our experiences.
Yeah, of course.
And then I just wonder what experiences make certain types of people and what experiences make other types of people. And and of course there's bigger considerations, like a culture swaying one side or the other. I believe that there was a time where people were more celebrating of generalists and people who were just generally handy to have around, and then I think a more sophisticated, which is not a good or a bad use of the word, but a more sophisticated international, cosmopolitan, outward and inward looking society or economy favors the specialist, and that's just a cultural trend. And I wonder if we'll sway back towards the generalist once
robots take over,
because they're the best specialists.
Yeah.
They're the ultimate specialists.
Yeah.
And until they become generalists, and then, oh, I don't know what we're going to do.
Yeah.
But there's even, I forget which book it is, but I'll put it in the show notes, but there's a book that is basically entitled that specialization is for insects, and that the true power of humans as beings is that we can be general and we can change what it is that we're working on in each moment, and what skills is the wrong word, it's like capacity is closer. but it's like a word that is in between your senses and your capacity. But whatever, that's like...
Potential?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
But yeah, that the true power of the human as a phenomena is that it can just be what it needs to be and then later be the other thing that it needs to be.
Hmm. Hmm.
And yeah. I wonder if we get scared away from that. And you and I and other people that we know were just lucky that they didn't get scared off from doing that as they grew up or as they began training for their professions or whatever.
Hmm. I mean, there is still... I mean... You know, I'm becoming more comfortable with the idea of getting good at accounting, but I still don't want to include that really in my identity.
But identity is interesting, isn't it? Because the wave in the pool and the wave on the piano and doing the wave on stage, are you doing a wave in accounting?
Hmm.
Like, are there just things that robots are going to eventually take over that... I don't know. We just hope they get there before we have to get there. I don't know what the answer is. Like, there seems like there are some things that really easily marry all the aspects of ourselves together. And then there are other things that we may end up doing that... Yeah, it's a contradiction in my thought, in my belief system. Because I believe that all the aspects of ourselves can come together and inform each other. And then I also believe that maybe that only works if I'm doing only the things that I'm interested in. And if I then go and do the things that I'm not necessarily interested in, but I am incentivized to partake in, maybe it doesn't facilitate a more whole and comprehensive self.
I mean, if you're looking for wholeness, you know, whatever that is. Well, I mean, so what are the sensations that come along with that?
Yeah.
And when do you feel more of them? Or when do you feel as parts of those sensations?
Yeah.
You know, when you're doing the things you like or not? Yeah. Doing the things you want to do or the things you don't want
to
do?
I think it's when you're on the way to being able to do the things that you wish you could do. I don't think it's when you already can do them. And I don't think it's when you already can do something that you're not interested in.
Oh, there was this watching this woman called Esther Perel. I think is her name, and she talks a lot about erotic desire and other things. But this something about the wanting or being in this in like a healthy wanting, whatever that means. Yeah. I don't know, but like that. The movement towards when you feel really powerful and full.
Yeah, wanting is a gift of its own. And there's... Yeah, you can go... So it used to be that you would be wanting until you had. But now you can be wanting until you've purchased and then still have to wait until you have, especially if things are getting delivered.
Right.
So you can want and then purchase and then know that it's yours legally, this thing now you own, but you still don't have it. And then depending on where the want came from and what fueled it, the way the distribution system's set up now is that you can... Somehow you go, like, you get beyond wanting very too soon. Like, you're not filled with the anticipation of this thing because you can purchase it too easily or too quickly, but you still haven't got it. So you don't, like, transition from wanting into the elation of achievement, of partaking. Somehow you transition from wanting into a conceptual knowing that you have. And I just think it changes the nature. I mean, I experience buyer's remorse often because of that very setup. And oftentimes I know, like, I've started to realize that it's the wanting that is giving me the most pleasure.
Yeah.
And if I realize that, then I don't think that it's so evil for, say, a company to bring out a device or product that makes the one that they recently sold me feel antiquated or redundant. Because what they've given me, if I can recognize it and take the pleasure from it, what they've given me is the gift of desire.
Yeah. I guess it just depends on whether that process makes the links that are useful between, you know, the use of wanting or, you know, the power of that, so that you can ride the wanting to the next wanting to the next wanting without necessarily needing to have the thing.
Yeah. I think we're better at wanting than we are at having. And I think that comes back to how we used to live in groups and how much relationships affect our state of being and our sense of wholeness and fulfillment, is because that's a wanting that we can never have. We can only temporarily enjoy or experience, but actually we don't ever possess the fulfillment of those things. And I wonder if at some point we've been set on the addiction to the wanting of the hit of realization that often comes with learning. When you get to learn things that you're interested in and you can access that information in the amount of time that you're still interested in it, so you don't have to enroll in a course, you can just look it up, and that you can take it in the medium that speaks to you, which is interaction or discussion or discourse or video tutorial or reading or mind map or infographic. And so it's like, I wonder if we're just lucky that our, I don't know, in inverted commas, addiction is to something that is culturally enshrined as a noble pursuit, which is that of learning and of knowing more and of understanding. I don't know either. I just know that a lot of what I feel like is myself is tied up in realizing, being exposed to things at the right time by the right people when I'm in the right state to then have realizations. And if I've had a few realizations, that means more to me than if I've had a few dollars thrown my way.
Yeah.
And that
and that's the realization, is that you can then buy food.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is pretty great.
It is pretty great. It's true. But there's something about that, isn't it? Like, it's, we're giving up a lot so that we can continue on this path of learning things. And it's lucky that that's kind of shaped as a noble pursuit. But in some, like, it,
I'm interested in the things part of that. Definitely. Is learning the same thing as gaining more knowledge or understanding? I'm not convinced that it is.
Great. I wonder if it's not either. I just wonder if a learning or a realization are the acts that give you the high or the serotonin hit in the same way that dancing or sweating or physical exertion gives you a little bit of a endorphin reward for your efforts. And that I know I get quite down if I don't get an endorphin hit. every few days from some kind of physical exertion. And I guess that's coming to be also a need that I have for the hit that I get from having a new realization.
But we have needs.
Yes, no. We do.
And that's true. That's, we need to eat.
Yeah.
We need to sleep. We need to do all sorts of things. I've been learning to be more at peace with that, I think. And I was recently at the Nonviolent Communication Festival in Denmark.
What was it called?
Nonviolent Communication. And the raising of the general consciousness of people taking care of their needs and just going, I want to be here, now I don't. I want to be elsewhere. Like, it was a very beautiful thing, you know, especially I was teaching a lot that week and you know, people were welcome to come when they liked and leave when they liked. And that meant that everyone who was there wanted to be in that room with me while I was teaching. And they were, you know, they could take what they wanted and leave what they wanted. And the teaching environment that allowed and the learning environment that allowed for everyone involved, gorgeous. They had this non-talent show at the end.
A non-talent show? Great.
It was so great. And there were little kids, like, doing their songs and people doing all sorts of things. It was probably one of the best performances I've ever seen, you know, with the connection to the audience and the aliveness and just the wanting to be there and the pleasure of that.
And so now that we're talking about something a little bit more tangible, like people coming together and actions taking place, I wonder if you are building something or if you're creating something at the moment or thinking about.
Well, I've been... in that festival, I was introduced to this video I forgot his name, but he wrote a book called Reinventing Organizations, and there's a talk on YouTube which goes for about an hour 40 talking about, you know, it gives a brief history of the various stages of human development and the sort of organizational developments that occurred in each time, you know, from tribal to agricultural to industrial to information age and beyond, and sort of talking about the next stage which we're stepping into, based more on the idea of distributed intelligence, you know, the idea that we have three brains, in our head and our heart and our gut, and they're autonomous. You know?
Yeah.
And yet they work together and they respond together and they, you know, and drawing parallels with the idea of the global economy and the forests and what happens in a single cell and all these sorts of things and how then you... people have started to create new organizations following these ideas and what that means and the power of that. And so I'm interested in learning more about this. I've been, you know, learning a lot about language the last couple of years, since that seems to be the way, you know, a way to communicate. But how to create the structures that allow people to be people.
Their best people.
Yeah, whoever they want to be at that time.
Yeah.
And work together to do what they want to do.
I often feel like I don't know what I want to be until I look around and see what is needed.
Hmm.
And then I start working it out.
Hmm. But I don't think it's I don't think it's at all important to know anything at all. Except for that, those moments of realization to springboard to the next one.
Mm.
But once you have it, drop it, you know, let it go back into the ether, and then it's still there. It will inform everything you do from that point.
Mm.
But you don't need to force it.
Mm.
You know? And so but asking the questions, I think that's important.
Yeah.
And clarifying your questions and loosening the questions and zooming in, zooming out. Mm. Foreground, background.
Do you have a favorite question?
How is my contact with the ground?
Delicious. Okay. My last question.
Hi.
And this is pretty new. This is one of my favorites. What is your hope? And that can be for you for the rest of the day, or it can be for the world for the rest of the day, or for everybody you know and love, or it can be for just what is your biggest hope?
Coming back to robots.
Yeah, let's keep coming back to robots.
Always started with it.
Do you know there are like bots?
Like bots?
Yeah, all they do is they go around on the internet and like things.
That's awesome.
It's really awesome.
But this whole business of transitioning to the next stage of humanity, right?
Mm. Whatever that is, whatever it looks like, whenever it happens, if we're still here.
Yeah. I'm hoping that we're still going to be here. Right? And I think it looks good.
Great.
So I'm hoping to just be involved in that.
Mm.
To, you know, if people are going to find different ways of forming meaning for themselves,
yeah,
because we need meaning, but it's, it needs to be dissociated from work,
yes,
from income,
yes,
all or these things need to be separated, yeah,
yeah.
What it means to be truly autonomous,
yeah,
you know, so and what it means to have, as a species, given birth to another which is going to surpass us, mm, right? Whatever that means, in whatever ways they do. But, you know, there are major shifts that we need to, you know,
consider,
move into.
Yeah. There's Robert Rodriguez, who's a film director. He was talking about the people who are not ready to shift. It's unfortunate when people at the forefront of the current paradigm are not ready to shift, because they're the ones who can best inform, mm, sometimes the next one. He was talking about film DOPs shifting from film stock to digital, and that because they were so against it, digital still came. But these professionals with many years of experience had no input into, mm, how it could be improved upon.
Mm.
And so now they just stuck with whoever was interested and whatever they decided it should be.
Mm.
But actually, if they had gotten on board, they could have really shaped it in a way that improved it. And I wonder if it's going to be like that for us. That hopefully the people who can do the best for it, the people who are most interested in our quality of longevity and connection as a community and as a culture and as a species and as just one of many species, hopefully they're going to have a voice when we're considering what the next paradigm shift is and how it's going to be and look like.
One of the things that I've been learning the most about is, you know, it's all well and good to have these big ideas about directions you'd like people to go in, or especially, you know, when you're teaching or that sort of thing. Just learn the damn thing, you know. But you can't do anything but meet someone where they are, you know, and be there to support their own path. And there are many different ways of doing that. And some I agree with, some I agree with less. But yeah, I think we've just got to keep meeting everyone around us where they are. And where we are. And still letting those directions be there in general, vague, moving towards them. But moving towards them might mean moving sideways for a while, or even going backwards and then forwards.
Cool. Is there anything else you feel like you want to talk about that I haven't led us towards? Or
I think that's a big enough idea.
It's a pretty big idea. I think that's a good place to finish.
Thank you.
Thanks, Julian.